So with that, I'm happy to take any questions. I know I'm freezing you a little bit in here, but Jeff, we'll start with you.
Thanks, Jeff. Two questions somewhat related. I guess on the first one, not to open old wounds, because it's been a very tough year for everyone, and a lot of companies made mistakes, including the one I work at. But the question really is, you know, you made the comment we ended up in some businesses we had no business being in. And, you know, when we think about kind of the rigor and management process at GE, how was it that you ended up in a set of businesses you shouldn't have been in? And what might change to make sure that doesn't happen again?
Look, Jeff, I think in financial services, if you go back over a long period of time, right, I think it's easy to enter businesses. You don't have to build factories and stuff like that. And, you know, we were a big LBO player in the late 80s. We were a big insurance player in the late 90s. We probably got too big in some consumer finance spaces and some commercial real estate spaces in this cycle. And, you know, my view is that, you know, maybe some of it was just too much liquidity. Some of it was too easy, you know, to drive incremental earnings growth. And then I just think some of it is, as you think about GE Capital going forward, they're going to pay their fair share on the dividend. You know, going forward, we're going to stick to those core businesses and just grow inside that bandwidth. So it's not like, you know, this is not an epiphany or anything like that. It's just, I think there ought to be a certain size. There ought to be a certain steady return hurdle. And I just think those businesses I outlined, there might be one or two others, but there won't be many. So I think that's what I say. Now, all that being said, look, in the short term, if we saw a good bulk origination opportunity in mid-market lending, we're going to go do it. Because where we're good, we're really good. And we should go do it. But that's, you know, I'm not making an excuse. That's just where we've been.
And then secondarily and somewhat related, when we think about GE Capital, and it may end up being just an issue of opinion, but kind of thinking about your entitlement to be in certain areas. I mean, I can understand the verticals and I can understand mid-market finance and anything doing with, you know, equipment leasing, capital finance and the like. I think where the justification problem comes is on consumer and real estate. And, you know, it just may be your strategic decision, but it seems to me that actually if you want to be compared to some of these other peers, it's going to be hard to break out of the sum of the parts math of having a finance company if you're in things that feel non-core to your industrial operations. Just your thoughts on that.
You know, Jeff, again, I view, when I think about the core competencies, you know, the analogy to technology in the financial side is being able to do things that are structured, being able to do things that really tap into our strong origination, risk management, financial discipline. So when I go through that list of core competencies, I include GE Capital as a part of it, really. Then I just think we have to be thoughtful as we go forward in the future. You know, retail sales finance, you know, lots of barriers to entry. We really are good at it. We do it better than banks. There's lots of scale advantages and things like that. PLCC, you know, been in it for 50 years. It was one of the cornerstones of the original GE Capital. This cycle clearly is amazing where we've ended up. But I think we have to be thoughtful about it going forward. Commercial real estate, definitely smaller. It's got to be places that leverage origination skill, risk management skill, things like that. But I think that the onus is going to be on doing fewer things better, having capital to return to the parent, and having margins that are better than banks. So I don't disagree with your big point. I may argue with a little bit on some of the, you know, pieces, but that's how I think about the company going forward. Scott?
Just to follow up on that a little, Jeff, I mean, talk to us about how maybe things have changed in the M&A process, the people, how you think about returns, et cetera.
So, you know, Scott, I've always thought that 15% cash on cash returns is a good target. I think the fact that people get paid on return on total capital is a good thing. We have a 16% return on total capital, so, you know, we start with a pretty good level. And I would just say that the further we got from these core strengths, the harder it is to has been to generate a return. But when you think about oil and gas and life sciences and avionics and renewables and services and controls, these are all 20% plus cash on cash returns, very effective, and we'd like to do more of those.
I mean, part of the question was just, has the M&A process changed? Have the people changed? Has there been, I mean, you know, just getting to the core of the question, how do you, if it's the same board and the same management team, how can you give us some assurance that the same mistakes wouldn't happen
I think we always learn from anything we do wrong. We have very formal review processes with the board. The deals we've done have generated cash on cash or industrial returns above our cost of capital, and some have done extremely well. You know, look, I just think if you're going to do some, BorgWarner didn't quite work. You know, you're going to have some that do better than others. But, you know, again, I think having good metrics in place on return on total capital, having good processes in place, maximize our chance of success. And I don't want to be a company that's just gun shy from doing inorganic opportunities, because I do think the ones I showed you are quite strong.
And last question, just, you know, you're making a $2 billion contribution to G Capital in the first quarter, and you talked about how first quarter of 11.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, of 11. That's based on the income maintenance agreement. Next year, there would be $2 billion in the first quarter of 11.
Okay. I suppose when you think about your reserve levels, what gives you confidence that $2 billion is enough?
Well, again, I think it's the $2 billion is just about, you know, pre-tax income, where the income is going to be, and what we have in place with the rating agencies is where you get the $2 billion. So I think that's kind of night follows day. It's formulaic and things like that. I think what you saw last week from Mike was a pretty good sense of our reserve levels and our losses as we go through next year, which gives us some confidence that flat earnings year over year is the right thing to be working on and to count on. Yeah.
Thanks, Jeff. Just to follow up again on the portfolio questions. Mm-hmm. So just to be crystal clear, you're not looking at anything inorganic outside of the core franchises. You're building in on the core franchises. And would you also consider stock transactions or anything transformational, or you're saying both core and small over the next sort of year and year and a half time frame?
Look, we've got ample opportunities in the core franchises we have to make whatever investment. So I don't see anything outside our core franchises. And we just have a very good industrial company, a very good one, that's got lots of opportunities for inorganic growth and organic growth. And so I just don't see that in the next period of time, mainly because I don't think we need it to achieve any of the goals that I spelled out for you today. So, you know, I mean, I just don't see it.
Okay, and if you think about the sort of implicit guidance and what you put up today,
I push back a little bit on that, you know, because implicit guidance.
I haven't asked the question yet.
Okay, good.
Okay, I'll use the word then.
The
framework that was put up there, right, and the size and shape of the bars.
Yeah.
When you think about the upside downside, particularly the downside to that, what are the biggest things that would move the needle on the downside from your perspective? And is there anything in the next, say, 12 to 18 months that would cause you to think that an equity raise might be necessary?
You know, again, I think that the sense for the environment is out there. You know, I would say, you know, the economy gets much worse than 10% unemployment. I mean, I think we kind of, what the GE Capital team took you through, you know, we've kind of modeled it that unemployment got worse, not better. You know, so I think we've tried to take a pretty good, pretty conservative look at where things go. So, you know, if the world just got a lot worse, you know, that would have an impact. But I think we've come through a pretty tough time period. I think that the U.S. government has given every indication that they are going to stay involved until they're sure this economy gets better. So it would have to be some externality outside of that that would be, you know, where we are. So your question on equity, I just don't see it. You know, in other words, if you think about having $23 to $26 billion of cash at the parent, having a capital, you know, tier one capital ratio that is growing and that is significant while we're shrinking and earning money, you know, I just don't see it.
Final question, Jeff. If you look at the TLGP commitments that you have, and given the changing mood in Washington or continuing mood in Washington with what we've seen through the House, et cetera, are there any signals of your hands being tied in any way or coming as a result of even that involvement in that program, recognizing it's not TARP or anything else? But are you feeling any restrictions
in
the business?
I don't think so. You know, in other words, the FDIC is going to get more than $2 billion, something like, I don't know, like $2.1 billion of fees from the TLGP. I think they like that program. Our bond spreads are now well inside what we issued debt for the TGLP. So, you know, I think we don't see that as being a pressure point. And then I just think it's who's the regulator going to be for GE Capital? And then what's the capital requirements and things like that? But guys, look, as you shrink and earn and get out of more highly levered businesses, our tier one capital grows, right? And so, you know, it just grows. Now, what we'd like to do is we'd like to, over this time period, return cash from GE. There should be, at some point, a big cash payday from GE Capital back to the parent. That should happen. Now, you know, I'm not the regulator, and I don't know when and stuff like that, but that is going to happen as we get out there. And I think that's how I view where we are. Did I make the point strong enough on this one? Because I just want to make sure that there's no mistaking. Cliff, we're going to have to get you a headband or something.
I'm sure that my girlfriend is on this call, and I'm going to blame it on her.
Okay. I'll let you handle that one.
I was surprised that you thought it would be a gas and a wind world when the economics still drive to nuclear, particularly with respect to wind, which exists only because of subsidies. Can you talk a little bit about, is that the political impediments? Well, let me just ask it simply. Why is that not on your list?
So we're in the nuclear business. We'll stay in the nuclear business. And I want to have, I think it's a good bet for the future to stay in the nuclear business. But it's just not for any of the guys at the front of the room here. None of us will see the fruits of that. It's really for our successors someday. You know, the nuclear business is a sovereign business. The governments decide how big it's going to be, right? When we bid on a deal in Abu Dhabi, we bid against the French government, the Korean government, and that's the nature of where the nuclear business is. We like the fuels business. It's profitable. I hope we get a couple of these big deals. But, you know, when we put it into our enterprise risk model, it's going to have to make sense for how we do it. I just think when you think about energy flexibility, where the current price of gas is, we like our gas position. We think that's a very strategic position. And wind is the renewable of choice. So if you get a clean energy standard, if you get any kind of renewable portfolio standards, Europe has decided there's going to be 30 gigawatts of offshore wind. I think those are the two technologies that really give you the best footprint. Yeah, Bob.
In the slide that showed the vision of GE in the future, there was a little sliver of consumer on the bottom and noticeably no consumer and industrial bar. I mean, does that suggest the spin of that business is still possible down the road?
You know, Bob, the way I think what we'll probably do is take the industrial businesses that really, with smart grid and how that's evolving, are a good fit with our other smart grid capabilities. So stick those into the smart grid. And when we talk about consumer, it's really appliances and lighting that are down in that balance. So the industrial business is small, and the sense it makes inside the company is really as part of the smart grid capability.
Question. You mentioned the structural tax credit. I wonder if you could take a minute with your colleagues here and talk about how big that structural tax credit is at Capital, where it comes from, and how stable it is looking forward over the next few years.
So, you know, what I would say is that, you know, we think that, you know, what we call subpart F, which is the structural part of G Capital, is, I don't know, Keith, what, $1.5 billion, $2 billion a year, something like that? About $1.5 billion or $2 billion a year, Bob. It's always had bipartisan support. It's got bipartisan support today. And so I very much think that will continue going into the future. So that was the stable part on the bar chart, right, Trevor? And then the negative was just saying as you earn pre-tax earnings, you're going to start, you know, we'll start paying taxes again. So that's a brief answer. Then you can hit Dr. Sharon in the break. Yeah.
So Jeff, you like oil and gas, but relatively speaking, you're overweight power gen, underweight oil and gas. Would you like over time to balance more towards oil and gas and make oil and gas maybe of similar size to your power gen assets?
You know, I think we like the space. I mean, we've been very pleased because it's got big customers that are like technology and things like that. But to be honest with you, we think we can do it organically. I mean, if you look at just in 2 or 3 years, what we've done with Vetco Gray and how well we've done vis-a-vis our competitors just in a couple years, really, if you run the tables in Australia and you do well in Brazil, you're going to win a lot of chips in that one. So I think oil and gas is a great place for us, but I think we can do a lot organically in oil and gas.
And then another quick one on GE Capital regulation. I mean, how are you thinking about the possibility of, you know, Fed or whoever else involvement in GE Capital? And, you know, what sort of break is that on your capital deployment in industrial in the parent balance sheet, you know, until, you know, the NBCU cash comes in?
Again, I think that the regulatory discussion is going to take place into next year. You know, I think if you think about, I mean, I don't know what its shape will look, but if you just look at what's known, which is the House, what was passed in the House last week, you know, it allowed for grandfathering. It allowed for some, I would say, operating flexibility between the industrial company and the financial service company. But a lot of that's yet to be determined, you know, and I think it'd be premature for me to talk much about it. I think that, again, the best thing I can say is that we were going to do. We would have been happy to do the Areva deal. That was 4 billion euros, and you know that basically passed muster. So, you know, I think we do have flexibility when you think about next year. Yeah. There.
Jeff, sounds pretty clear from your discussion on capital allocation that buyback is a priority over dividend to GE shareholders. But wondering if you could put your thinking there in context. Timing, and how you think about the uncertainty on tax and regulation and the finance
on side. On the just in terms of capital allocation and stuff like that. So I maybe just walk through the page because what I wanted to try to do was just leave you with the sense that there's lots of optionality and that we're going to think through all of them. So on GE Capital, I really think that we can operate our way into a good, you know, tier one capital ratio. And that we talk about $2 billion in the income maintenance agreement for first quarter of 2011. That's not a bad base case, I don't think, for GE Capital. I don't. You know, I think our transparency around losses and stuff like that has been good with investors. I think we've marched through this year. And so, you know, I think that's point number one. Then if we see some good inorganic growth opportunities, we're going to capitalize on them, you know, but they're going to have to meet our return criteria. We think we can be patient. If opportunities present themselves, we're going to go for it. But that's on the list as well. Dividend, you know, we believe that the good payout ratio for GE is 40 to 50% payout ratio as earnings improve. We should be able to accommodate that and grow the dividend. And then buybacks, we should just be thoughtful and reflective of where the stock price is, cash available, what's a good return, cognizant of the ratings and stuff like that. And so that's That's how we think about it. Now, you know, look, I think we've had lots of discussions about GE Capital. As we get smaller, as GE Capital starts, you know, generating good pre-tax earnings growth again and things like that, there's going to come a point in time when we can dividend back to the parent, you know, and vis-a-vis what comes out of GE Capital. So I don't see having to put a lot more capital into GE Capital. I think $2 billion is not a bad way to think about it. And as we go through the year, we should have substantial available cash to do the smartest things we possibly can for the long-term growth and health of the company.
Two-parter on restructuring. First, why the uncertainty on the 2010 restructuring? And then longer term, kind of thinking out to that 2012 period and beyond, just in the longer term generally. You know, one of the questions we get a lot in terms of that discussion with investors is, will we see better margin performance in industrial on the OE side based on all this restructuring that's gone on in the last couple of years, or how we should think about that in that longer term context?
Look, I think the being able to do $6 billion over the last couple of years has really been, I think, important to get our cost structure down. You see it in our 2007 base costs were something like $44 billion, something like that. And 2010 base costs will be something like $38 billion. So taking really legitimate on the ledger $6 billion of cost out over that time period. I think it's just a matter of what the projects look like. We did a lot of restructuring in 2009 that was opportunistic as we went through the year. And so we just want to be able to do that again in 2010 if the opportunities arise. I'm sorry, the last part of your question.
I mean, think about the challenges on the industrial margin expansion in those 6 to 8 periods.
So, look, I mean, I would say, you know, let's say that I don't know if this is trough cycle, but in a tough cycle, right? We're at 16% operating profit rates. I think that the service model is holding. You know, and our profit rates and services are growing. So I think that's one piece of it. The business mix, you know, actually NBC out of the mix is accretive and not dilutive. So that helps. And then, you know, through this cycle, both the contribution margin rates of the original equipment and the operating margin rates of the original equipment should be able to grow, you know, based on the footprint reductions we've done and things like that. We had a good year in 2009 because we had price and cost down. I think if you think about 2010, we have a good sourcing year, pretty much locked in for 2010. And pricing won't be quite as good as it was in 2009 because we had done a lot of deals pre-crisis in 2009 that held. But on balance, we'll still have a positive value gap in 2010. And, you know, look, to hit 16 at a bad part of the cycle is pretty good. Pretty good. Steve.
Just a little more on the acquisition front. If you could maybe just define a little bit more around what you talk about as the core. You're heavy in generation. You went after the distribution side. You say you want to focus really on smart grid. You know, smart grid is obviously a huge space. You know, how do we think about that? Is it home and building controls? Do you throw appliances in there, smart appliances into that bucket? You know, maybe if you could just clarify a little bit around how you would define broadly, you know, that smart grid space.
I think T&D, Steve, is a pretty good, you know, it's a pretty good example of maybe the type of deal. You know, so it was our bid was like an 8x EBITDA. It was a business that we thought we could scale into the infrastructure that we had inside energy. We had an experienced leadership team with John Krenicki and his guys that could do it. So we could see the synergies. We had high faith that the synergies would take place. We had a pretty good return profile on a deal like that. So that's not a bad deal to kind of model vis-a-vis what we would think about from an M&A transaction. I think in smart grid, you basically have, you know, things like smart meters and the places that are distributed that go to the home. You've got really software and equipment that is part of the operation of the utility, some of which we're growing homegrown, some of it we have in digital energy inside the company. Transmission and distribution is a piece of it, so that's going to be a piece of it. And then in the home, in appliances, you're going to have a control center, and you're going to have appliances that have the digital signal that can do the smart grid in the home. And in those four or five areas, that basically is about 40 or 45% of the content in terms of what would be considered a smart grid. So inorganic opportunities might be in the software side. It might be in some of the communications equipment that takes place in order to get the smart grid working. Those would be the inorganic type opportunities, but they're on the small side. Yeah.
So it seems like some of the details and commentary around the financial side are improving, in some cases weakly, with respect to the 2% ROI target now. You know, some commentary around 2% plus and running well ahead of that currently. Is your sense now that the period with the circle of competitors shrinking for getting those much higher ROIs is really being a lot more durable than you might have thought even a quarter or two ago?
I think it's a great question. It's a hard one to answer because I don't think the industry's stabilized yet. The competitive landscape clearly has changed. And if you had capital this year, you could price for it. The demand wasn't that strong, quite honestly. And throughout a lot of the year, the demand has not been, I mean, our origination is up, has grown sequentially, but there still is not a tremendous amount of demand. All that being said, I think all of our teams feel like a 2 ROI is a pretty good steady state target for our teams, even with the current underwriting we're doing being significantly in excess of that. But that, you know, we don't think necessarily today is representative of what will be the case a year, 2 years, 3 years from now as this thing normalizes again. Couple more? One more? Out of Cliff, maybe?
You gave us some great examples of successes in inorganic platforms. Tell us what you learned from the things which were not successes. And I don't want to pick on water, but it might be a good example.
Look, water was, we paid too much for growth that was hard to materialize, and we had no foundational point in the company to plug it into. So we ran it as a freestanding business, having paid 415 times EBITDA. So what do you learn? Don't pay so much and put things inside core businesses, right? But I guess we're a company that's got a 16% return on total capital, right? We generate a lot of cash. And doing inorganic growth is always going to be one where you're going to make some mistakes as you go through it. But I would say, Cliff, I really think if you go beyond 10 times EBITDA, it is hard to make it pay, even when you plug it into a superstructure that you've got. I mean, that's how I would triangulate. How much you pay? Plugging it into John Kroenicke or John Rice or those core businesses, that's how we've been the most successful. Any last ones? Yeah.
Lots of companies have had risk control committees and risk control procedures. Can you describe what you're doing now that's different in risk control or risk management than before?
So we always had very formal spread of risk and risk policies inside GE Capital, pre-crisis and post-crisis, always been in place. I think what we've added to that is a much bigger and broader enterprise risk model that is more anticipatory, that looks more across the entire company when you think about risk. So we've just got a lot broader focus across the company, even while we've had the granular focus inside GE Capital. And I'd say, like lots of companies, the board oversight on risk has always been in place, but has been beefed up significantly as you think about where we are and how we go forward. One last one. Go two more. One here and then.
Thank you, Jeff. Zahid Siddiq, Gabelli & Company. Could you comment on what you're seeing out there within the commercial real estate arena? I know you touched on it. Last week, I read somewhere that Dubai World had invested $250 million roughly in the W Hotel, and they just sold it for about $1 million. And the numbers that you have presented within your real estate sector or segment, you know, I think they indicated a loss of about $7 billion roughly. And so I wanted to see if you could comment on what you're seeing at a broader level and if your loss estimates are realistic within that scheme.
So, you know, Ron Pressman went through it in detail last week. And again, I think how we've reflected our equity book is pretty true to what we're seeing. I think on the debt side, you know, we've already taken an increased reserves, and we've got a very strong focus on that and disciplines around the reserving on the debt side. I think we see a little bit more liquidity coming into the marketplace, you know, but, you know, it's still probably inside the GE Capital portfolio, the one that we're watching the hardest. And basically the focus is on the operating piece, you know, what's occupancy, how are we doing on doing releasing and things like that. So that's where ultimately this is going to be decided, is how good a job do we do at operating these assets through this downturn? That's how the team gets compensated, and that's what's going to determine where the commercial real estate losses go. But I think we've framed it for investors. I really do. I mean, I can't think of one thing more that we could be giving you about commercial real estate. Yeah, one last one.
Thanks. Jeff, you've mentioned Arriva a few times during this discussion, and one of the questions that comes out of that is how else do you play the bundled power generation transmission distribution awards and bids for emerging markets without that asset such that you don't actually lose share on the generation side or on new bids?
So, look, I think, first of all, we have a position, right? We're probably number five in the marketplace and things like that. But, you know, we've got a number of discussions going with potential global partners in places like China that we think could add to our portfolio if that's the direction we have to go. So I think we're pretty cool about, we were never naive about where Arriva was going to go. I mean, believe me, we were in, but we were never stupid about where that thing was going to go. But we have two or three other steps, I think, that can make sure we protect ourselves. Joint ventures with big companies globally, that kind of thing. So, have a nice holiday. It's great, good questions, and the team's going to be around to answer more questions that you might have. So, thanks.